Before we proceed with the case that's on the agenda for today, I want to, on behalf of the court, welcome students from the Marinette Public Schools. There are some that are outside and some that are in the courtroom. Would these students please stand? Thank you for coming today. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that's sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to attend an oral argument. If they agree to attend, they are given materials about the case and come and listen to an oral argument. Students who come in the morning meet with a justice at noon to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. If the students have time after this oral argument is completed, Justice Crooks will talk to you about the procedures and answer any of your questions. If you do not have time and have to leave, we understand that, but that decision can be made at the end of this proceeding. If you would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, the Deputy Marshal, Mr. Pond, has summaries. So if you raise your hand, if you wish to get a summary, we can give it to you. All right. I've introduced the students to everyone. Let me introduce the court. Sitting on this case, on my far right, is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far left is Justice Patience Robensack. Justices Ziegler and Gabelman are not participating in this case. With those introductions made, I will now call 06AP2851, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Joseph Summers. Representing himself is Attorney Joseph Summers. Mr. Summers, you have 25 minutes, and then if you want to, you have rebuttal for five. Mr. Summers, first thing you have to do is stand and appear in front of the microphone, because we record the oral argument should the court want to listen to it, and that microphone also amplifies so that others may hear you.
Your Honor, I was just going to request that I be permitted to go 20 minutes on my direct and 10 minutes on my rebuttal.
Ms. Fork, do you have any objection? That's not the typical. Do you have any objection to that? You may do that, Mr. Summers. No problem.
Okay.
Mr. Pond, you'll change the light. So at the end of 20 minutes, you will get a red light. At the end of 15, you'll get a yellow. Did I say that properly, Mr. Pond? Okay. Now you should have a green light. Let's do that, shall we? Thank you.
Okay, Attorney Joseph Summers on his own behalf, if it pleases the court. I would begin with, I think that there are four factual propositions that have been overwhelmingly proven that I don't believe any objective, fair-minded person could say otherwise in the face of the overwhelming evidence. First, there was a fraudulent prosecution was commenced against Adam Raisbeck. It was a criminal conspiracy, and it was orchestrated from the Dane County District Attorney's Office, and it utilized an expert in that regard. This conspiracy engaged in putting up perjured testimony, putting up knowingly falsified expert data, and included fraudulent warrants in order to coerce a teenage boy into committing perjury. Second, the misconduct on the part of the Dane County District Attorney's Office was brought in formal motions to the Dane County Circuit Courts. Sworn affidavits were provided to the Dane County Circuit Courts substantiating the misconduct, including conduct which was criminal. Rather than acting in an irresponsible fashion, the Dane County Courts decided to cover up for what had taken place, to attempt to bully, to intimidate, and to browbeat me into backing off. This even culminated at one point with the trial court under Judge Higginbotham falsifying an order in order to cover up for the prosecutorial misconduct that had taken place. 3. OLOR, the Office of Lawyer and Regulation, which has characterized itself as this court's in-house law firm, rather than acting in a responsible fashion, decided itself to cover up for the misconduct on both the Dane County courts and on the Dane County judges. Their actions included falsifying the record. It included withholding documents that they were mandated to turn over to what is called the PRC, and it also included them taking off of the table the worst allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, including that which is criminal, in regards to their purported investigation of the Dane County District Attorney's Office. It included as well them assigning an attorney to investigate whether or not there had been misconduct on the part of Paul Humphrey, the Dane County prosecutor, which included the subordination of perjury. They assigned an attorney who was then involved in a business relationship with Robert Kranz, who was the individual who was alleged to have committed perjury in this matter, and whom the evidence to him committing perjury has been even acknowledged by a number of individuals, including both Judge Higginbotham and Judge Pakowski. Then we have the fourth factual proposition. Going as far back as September 29, 2003, there were efforts made by Attorney Summers to inform this court to what had been taking place. This court, rather than acting upon the information that it has received, including the substantial evidence that has been provided to it, instead has, for whatever reason, stayed its own rules, permitted the Office of Lawyer Regulation to repeatedly engage without any sanction whatsoever in conduct that is objectively misconduct and in some cases even criminal. This goes so far to what has taken place that it would, in any fair-minded person's mind, be not only most troubling, but would even go so far as to people to say, how can you have legal proceedings in such an atmosphere? How can any fair-minded person not conclude that it is a farce? We have, in regards to this, the conduct in regards that relates to this court, documents were taken not once, but not twice out of my file. They were not misfiled, as this court wanted it to be characterized, but rather that it could be proven by this court's own record index that these documents had been filed correctly, and then after that, again, not once, but not twice, they were taken out. What did these documents show? These documents substantiated, one, the misconduct on the part of the Dane County District Attorney's Office, which again was criminal. Two, these documents substantiated that this court's in-house law firm had knowingly engaged in falsified representations in a systematic way. And these documents were very much similar to the documents that had been originally withheld by this court's in-house law firm from the PRC. Then it gets further. It goes further. Then we have this court appointing a referee. A referee who went so far, apparently, to cover up for the misconduct in the Dane County courts and to what had taken place in this case, that he inserted a paragraph into his decision, which was publicly disseminated. A paragraph which was completely false. A paragraph to make it appear as if the Dane County courts had actually reacted strongly against the prosecutorial misconduct that had, that was shown, when in fact it was the exact opposite. What really had taken place was the exact opposite of what this court's referee put into his decision. And he could not have gotten his facts from the record because they did not exist, which means he made up the whole story. It is possible that he pulled the same facts from an article in the Wisconsin State Journal, but as this court well knows, the Wisconsin State Journal retracted that particular paragraph because, well, it was false. But then it goes on from that. We also have the same referee, who was appointed by this court, originally granting me what was called a counterclaim, then prohibiting me from putting evidence on behalf of the counterclaim, and then claiming on the record that he had never granted me a counterclaim, only to reverse himself later on and to admit that he had granted me a counterclaim, only to reverse himself later on to say that he had never done so. All of this captured in transcript pages. All of this proving his dishonest conduct, and yet this court, of course, did nothing. In regards to, as well, into the misconduct that has been shown to this court, my yellow light has already come on.
Yes.
I don't believe I've been up here for more than 10 minutes.
It's been 15 because you started at a quarter of. But go ahead. You've got 15, okay. You've got 5.
Anyway, I find that surprising, but okay. In regards to what has taken place with that, this court in regards to the referee, this court was given on numerous occasions evidence showing that the first count against me was based upon an out-and-out falsification. There can be no doubt at this time that it was a falsification. The Office of Lawyer Regulation claimed to have found in Adam Raisbach's court file a subpoena that had been served. Well, of course, as everybody knows, it has never been found. Even the Office of Lawyer Regulation concedes that at this point in time. But that's what set in motion me being charged. That's what set in motion the papers picking it up. That's what set in motion my reputation being destroyed, me being financially destroyed. It's interesting that Judge Prosser was so concerned about what takes place with CCAP, how people's reputations can be destroyed by false allegations to which they are later acquitted or the charges are dropped. But when it comes to me, this court has no concern. It has no concern whatsoever that that took place and it was orchestrated by this court's very own in-house law firm and its director, something that cannot be honestly disputed by anyone. Just as well, I find myself in front of a tribunal right now who's the son of one of these judges, Justice Crooks' son, has threatened me with being criminally charged, threatened me with civil action, threatened me that Oluar, to sick Oluar upon me. And for what? Just because I publicly informed the public on a radio show, honestly, on the Mitch Hanks show, that Justice Bukowski had conceded under oath that the evidence is that Justice Crooks' son's client committed perjury, lied falsely, on behalf of the Dane County District Attorney's Office. Now, if I think for any fair-minded person, they would be concerned, they would be troubled. Isn't this a conflict of interest? But apparently, there is no concern from this court. We go forward. Everyone else, basically, we have arguments that are in the paper about how this court is worried about this conflict of interest, that conflict of interest in regards to Justice Gableman, Justice Ziegler, who are not even here, apparently for some apparent conflict of interest, but I don't know what that could possibly be. But anyways, these justices are not here. But Justice Crooks is here. And how can that be? And I'll just close up, because apparently this court doesn't have any dispute about the facts that I put forth, which were all basically also included in my brief from page, I think it's 3 to 46.
Mr. Summers, I'm going to interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
Because the Deputy Marshal has just indicated to me, you were right. It was a fast 20 because the computer clock was running on fast time. I'm sure you've had that experience sometimes with taxis and their meters. Well, that happened to our meter today. So you have an extra about 5 minutes. Would that be all right? Go ahead. I just wanted you to know.
Okay. Now, just so I'm just sorry, what's the bottom line right now? How much time do I have right now? Thank you very much. Okay. In regards to...
Well, I'd like to ask you, you made a comment about me. Are you asking me to withdraw from the case?
No, I'm asking you to show me the same level of concern you have expressed publicly. You have acknowledged that false allegations on CCAP, where people are acquitted, where charges are dismissed, people's lives are ruined and destroyed. Yet your own in-house law firm, without a doubt, falsely accused me.
You have represented as a fact that the Office of Lawyer Regulation is our in-house law firm. I think that is a totally inaccurate representation. The Office of Lawyer Regulation is an agency that prosecutes violation of the ethical rules, but by no stretch of the imagination, for me, is that our in-house law firm.
Well, Your Honor,
I can never get advice from them.
Well, Your Honor, I find that to be somewhat amusing, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, because they characterize themselves as your in-house law firm in this case. That was quite some time ago. If that was your opinion, I would have thought you would have voiced it well before today. But that wasn't my characterization. That was their characterization in this very case, in a brief I know that you received. So I don't think it is at all unfair for me to have characterized them in that fashion. But what's even more important is, Your Honor, there's no doubt that the director of this firm, be it your in-house law firm or be it something else, it is supervised by this court. And the director, without a doubt, fabricated, he falsified the most critical assertion against me. It was false. It can be easily shown as being false. It has been shown to you to have been false on numerous occasions. And yet this court did nothing, even though this court had to have known that his falsification would destroy my reputation, would destroy me financially. I have plenty of children, Your Honor. In fact, that's where I'll end up with. Back on September 29, 2003, I alerted this court. At that time, I told this court, I tremble at what I find myself faced with at this juncture. I have 9 children, and my wife and I expect a 10th next spring. I do not lightly put myself in a situation where, for all practical purposes, my means of supporting my family may be seriously jeopardized. But on the other hand, what has occurred in the above-captioned case is such an outrage of justice and common decency that my responsibility as an attorney for Adam Raisbach and as a citizen compels me to act. The only thing about that paragraph that would have to be corrected would be now I have 13 children versus 9. Everything else is the same. And in that very letter, I didn't just make some wild allegation. I detailed it, and I provided this court with the very transcript pages that proved Judge Higginbotham had falsified the record in order to cover up for prosecutorial misconduct, dishonesty on the part of the Dane County District Attorney's Office. And this court did nothing. And instead, I have found myself, I guess my finances seriously jeopardized, it'd be more accurate to say wiped out. I suppose I'm up to my time.
Well, you have a few more minutes. Your time is up at a red light.
Okay.
And you have 10 minutes after Ms. Falk speaks.
If there is any, are there any questions?
Well,
no questions?
One of the things, Mr. Summers, is you have been, I believe, advised that your allegations regarding the conduct of OLR were going to be taken up, if you wish, after this proceeding, and that they were two separate proceedings. So I wanted that to make that clear to you.
Your Honor, by what basis does this court do so? The Supreme Court rules, from what I see, gives no authority for that to take place, number one. Number two, think about what has been said. For 4 years now, this court has stayed its own rules. Is that not a green light for Oluwaru to continue in their systematic dishonesty? As I told the court, that is what would occur, and that is what has occurred. It never stops, as I even showed in my reply brief, even up to this very moment. They make assertions that not only are false, but assertions they know that every single one of you knows is false. Is it not reasonable to conclude that Oluwaru would view the whole thing as, we got your back, Summers has to go down, do whatever you can. We must discredit him because he is too much of a danger to what goes on and to what this court has permitted to go on. I believe any rational, fair-minded person would see it in such a way. And I don't know why, and I don't know by what authority you have to stay it. What right do they have to engage in systematic misconduct? What right do they have to engage in perjury? What right do they have to withhold documents and say, well, sometime down the road, we're going to deal with it? I don't think that's just, especially when you're talking about destroying a man's profession, destroying a man's reputation, wiping him out. This is a very intelligent court. This court knows what Oluwaru has done. This court knows that that's why we have rules that are supposed to be put into place. And I do not understand, for the life of me, why they would be stayed to, basically, for the benefit of attorneys who, in this court's name, have been proven to engage in the most systematic dishonesty. I do not understand.
Mr. Summers, I have a question. There were three counts that OLR brought against you. My understanding is the referee found that you were not violative of the first count, but found that you were violating the code in regard to two counts. One of those counts had to do with what occurred in front of Judge Bukowski and what allegedly you said to Judge Bukowski. Do you take issue with that particular finding of the court, of the referee?
Sure, I take issue with it. Any fair-minded person would take issue with it. The fact and why I take issue with it, which I'm assuming you're asking me, is because what I said to Judge Bukowski that day, was it disrespectful? I'm not going to argue that it wasn't. Was I out of hand? I won't argue that it wasn't. But what I said that day, and this is what I've been charged with, and this is the clever thing, is as if what I said was false. As if what I said was in reckless disregard for the truth. And that is false. Everything I said that day, I said in good faith. And everything I said that day has been substantiated. Judge Bukowski, by his own admission when he was deposed, was presented in form of motion with evidence of misconduct after misconduct after misconduct, which he has admitted would have violated the due process rights of Adam Raisbeck. When he was judge, he did nothing, nothing at all. When he was deposed, he was asked why. He refused to give an answer. And Judge Bukowski has conceded that there is evidence of perjury. He has conceded that four affidavits submitted by the Dane County District Attorney's Office were, by the evidence, false. He has conceded that the Dane County District Attorney's Office, up to Brian Blanchard, withheld exculpatory evidence. And yet he did nothing. And so with that, and the last fact I'll put in is, again, too, with the referee, remember, in the findings that he made, that was after he disregarded 6 days worth of evidentiary hearings that were held, to which he decided, after the fact, they didn't count. And with that, I suppose my red light.
Counsel 40.15 says, failing to maintain respect due to a court or judicial officer.
Your Honor, I'm sure this court has to know, from the very beginning of this case, I said that if that's what I'm accused of, I would admit to it. I told that to Oluwaru, but that's not why the thing moved on. What Oluwaru insisted was that I admit that basically that I concede, otherwise I guess face room, but what I concede is that what I said in court was not in good faith. And that is false. Everything I said that day was true. And I have proven it to be true over and over and over again. And again, if evidence doesn't count, well, then what can I do?
Counselor, who was it that required that you concede That what you said before Judge Bukowski was not truthful?
Well, the lawyer actually said that in order for basically that count to be taken away. It came up in front of the referee on a number of occasions. The record is very clear that I said, if I'm being accused of being disrespectful, I concede it. Olivar said, no, I would have to concede that the statements that I said in court were in reckless disregard for the truth, to which I said no. I do want some rebuttal time because given how these proceedings have played out, she will make a number of statements that would be categorically false. I want the chance to respond, so how much time do I have left?
You'll get that chance.
Well, thank you.
You're now on our time.
Okay.
And we ask you questions after the red light. That's
all right. I didn't know that.
I know. Those are the rules of the court, and that's fine. And do you have a question?
Yes, I have a couple of questions. With regard to count two, which was the subject of Justice Crooks' question or your response, as I understand count two, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's why I'm asking the question, that I understand it was alleging that you engaged in loud, disorderly, contemptuous, or insolent behavior during a hearing before the circuit court on May 24th, 2004, in violation of one of the SCRs, that you engaged in conduct intended to disrupt a tribunal in violation of one of the SCRs, it's 20.8.2a, that you made a statement that the lawyer knows to be false or with reckless disregard as to the truth or falsity concerning the qualifications or integrity of a judge, and that, et cetera. So it sounds to me like count two covers quite a bit of territory, which includes both the violation of disrespect to a tribunal and disorderly, contemptuous, or insolent behavior before a judge, as well as the making a false or reckless statement with disregard of the truth. Is that your understanding of count two? And if it is, then it sounds like you're acknowledging at least a partial violation. Can you respond to that, please?
Yes. First, it is my understanding that these are like the elements. And again, one of the elements, the way that it was portrayed to me, and it had come up, was that I would have to concede that I made a statement with reckless disregard for the truth. That never happened. That's false. Second, in regards to whether or not my behavior was disruptive and insolent and so on, I concede that although this is a subjective matter, somebody in good faith could see it that way. I also, though, believe that mitigating factors are, in terms of justice, have to be seen. And it must not be overlooked that throughout Raisbeck and prior to that proceeding, there had been significant attempts to bully me, to browbeat me, to intimidate me, even twice to falsely accuse me on the stand, one even being right before the outburst. Judge Bukowski knew I hadn't engaged in any innuendo. If you look at when the so-called outburst took place, it was right after he says to me something to the effect, you engage in innuendo and you can accuse anyone of anything. He knew at that moment in time, I had given him roughly a dozen, I believe it was, or so, affidavits. I didn't make any reckless allegations. In fact, the whole issue of that day was, would he permit me to prove what people had put forth in a subpoena? He was saying, you can't prove what they put forth in the subpoena, not only at an evidentiary hearing, but at a trial. That's right, at a trial he was saying this evidence can't even come in. I hadn't accused anybody by innuendo. I went out of my way to do it by the book, and I went out of my way to get evidence. 12 people. We had Kevin McCoy. That's why this whole McCoy thing, which the referee falsified, it just sins against the light. Kevin McCoy was one of the people there to testify to how he'd been browbeat, testify to how they tried to coerce him with a fraudulent warrant in order to commit perjury against his own friend.
Something is immoral is the way as I see it. Something that's destructive to our court system. He was there to testify. And Judge Murkowski, despite all of his obligation under the law, refused to let him and other individuals there that very day and on a prior day testify to how, to what had taken place. There was no innuendo, Your Honor. Everything I said was true, and Judge Murkowski knew it. And he knew he was falsely accusing me. And that's what he did. And should I have lost my temper? No, I shouldn't have lost my temper. I am a flawed man, and I apologize for having raised back. I got him off, but I probably could have done a little bit better job, but I'm a flawed man. But I did the best I could in light of all the criminal conduct and all the things that were taking place. And I came to this court. I pleaded with this court. I showed this court the state statute, but this court had the power to intervene. And this court did nothing. And instead, I found myself ruined, wiped out. Everything I did in that case was decent. I did the best I could, and I was honest. And yet this court, whether it's your in-house law firm, it's your firm that you control, you gave them a green light to wipe me out, to falsely accuse me, and they've done it. And they're going to get up here in a couple of minutes, and they're going to continue with outrageous false statements if the past is any predictor to the future.
Thank you, Mr. Summers. You have 10 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Scott, representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation, you have 30 minutes.
May it please the Court, my name is Julie Scott, and I represent the Office of Lawyer Regulation in the current disciplinary proceedings. We are here today to discuss the disciplinary proceedings against Joseph L. Summers. It is not the forum to discuss the disciplinary proceedings against Humphrey. This is not the forum to discuss the integrity of the DA's office, the Dane County judges, or this court. This is not the forum, as stated by Justice Shirley Abramson, to discuss if Mr. Summers feels that the OLR and its agents committed misconduct and ethics violations during the disciplinary proceeding. His avenue, or the correct forum, is to file a malfeasance claim under SCR 2225.
But counsel, doesn't some of that information provide the context? We are here to determine not only violations, but if violations occurred, the level of discipline. And isn't that information important to provide context for our determinations?
Mr. Summers had a right to present affirmative defenses in the underlying disciplinary proceeding. If he felt that there was anything that affected the results of the disciplinary proceeding, whether or not he engaged in misconduct under counts 1 through 3 of the disciplinary case, he had a right to bring those issues up during the disciplinary
Doesn't that deal with whether or not there was a violation? As I said, if there is a violation, we have another issue to address, and that is the level of discipline. And I don't understand, I might be wrong, that's why I'm asking you. I don't understand why some of that information isn't available for purposes of context for the second part of our inquiry if we get to it.
Do you say that it's not available as to the evidence isn't on the record, or it's not available per se to discuss?
I don't know. I heard your comments to be really narrowing what we should focus on. That's what I heard your introductory comments to be. This isn't to talk about whether or not what went on in the circuit court was right or wrong. This isn't to talk about what went on with the district attorney's office is right or wrong. This isn't to talk about, and so I heard you really narrowing it, and I'm just asking, is it your position that we can't consider any of that? Isn't that information helpful for context? Now, you can say no to that, because that's a question, and I would appreciate an answer.
Well, I believe that the referee in his report and recommendation properly concluded that he could not make an ultimate determination as to whether or not the OLR or its agents engaged in misconduct under SCR 2225. However, he did listen to the affirmative defenses of Mr. Summers and did take those facts into consideration in making his determinations in this case. If you look at the referee's report, the referee did indicate that his decision was based upon both the evidence and the witness testimony at the disciplinary proceeding, and also the motions and the deposition testimony that was submitted by Mr. Summers throughout the case. So that was something that he listened to and he took into consideration in making his determination, but he couldn't make the ultimate determination in the disciplinary proceedings as to whether or not there was actual misconduct or malfeasance by any of the agents.
Counsel, count one is not what we're here about, because the referee did not make a finding that Mr. Summers violated count one of the complaint. But I have some concerns about it, given Mr. Summers' representation, that it was count one that really brought this whole matter about. And that all deals with the subpoena, and it was his frustration over the subpoena for Mr. McCoy that seems to have caused a lot of problems, problems with the DA about his statements in regard to that, problems with Judge Bukowski about the way in which Mr. Summers tried to proceed on that issue to get it straightened out, and then, of course, problems for him with the OLR because of the filing of the complaint. OLR has not appealed the referee's findings, so in my view, then, you are not asking us to conclude that they met their OLR met its burden of proof in regard to count one, correct?
No, OLR is respecting the decision of the referee who found that Mr. Summers did not violate count one of the disciplinary complaint.
Okay, my next question for you is, if you never had count one to file at all, and you had to file a complaint based on count two for the conduct that occurred in relation to that in count three, would the complaint have been filed anyway, or would there have been some other avenue that OLR might have proceeded upon?
No, if OLR would not have pursued count one of the complaint, although just to emphasize, the OLR still believes that it had sufficient evidence to pursue count one. However, the referee found that we hadn't met our burden. We would have still pursued the complaint based upon counts two and three.
Okay. Now, it isn't always necessary. No, wrong word. It isn't always the habit of OLR to file a complaint when a lawyer does something that really is not appropriate under our rules, correct?
Could you clarify that question?
Sure. There are times when OLR will issue a warning letter to a lawyer, rather than filing a formal complaint, or take some action that's less formal than a complaint. Is that fair?
There are different levels of discipline. I mean, we have diversion, we have public reprimands, we have private reprimands.
I'm just going to before the complaint. Say that I'm trying to see if there was some other way OLR could have approached this rather than filing a formal complaint if we eliminate count one. What is my purpose here.
In this instance, the OLR still feels that a suspension is the appropriate discipline in this case, just based upon a violation of counts two and three. And if there is a suspension requested or recommended by the OLR, then a complaint does need to be filed.
Okay, so this is not a case, in your view, where the OLR would normally take a different tact other than filing a complaint, even if we just X out count one?
No, not when a suspension is at issue.
Well, how do you know what's at? I mean, do you
not
always,
when the OLR has reviewed the complaint, the factual and legal issues with regard to the complaint under Wisconsin case law, the precedent, and the ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions, and have determined that a suspension is in line with the misconduct that occurred in this case.
Okay, I understand. So in this, even if we forget count one, for counts two and three, it would have been your normal procedure to file a complaint anyway because you thought those counts warranted some type of suspension. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. That helps me.
Ms. Scott, I've got a couple of questions. One, in looking at the facts here, I note that the complaint was filed in mid-November of 2006, November 17, 2006. First of all, can you explain to me why it's taken 4 years to get to this hearing today? At least given my experience on this court, which now is into its 15th year, I find it unusual that it would take that long. Can you give me some explanation as to why it's just short of four years from the time of the complaint till we're here today?
Sure. This was a very contentious, highly litigated case. There were there was a lot of discovery performed in the case. If you look at the referee's decision, the referee indicates a part of the extensive discovery. The referee states on page 3, second, there was extensive discovery. Summers took many depositions and there were many conferences. The depositions included nearly all the judges involved in the Raceback case, the director of OLR, the chairman of the district committee investigating the Summers and Humphrey matters, expert witnesses involved in the Raceback case, members of the district attorney's staff, members of the Dane County Sheriff's Department, and others. I know that at one point that we were in the case, there was over 80 hours in depositions taken in the case itself. So there was a lot of discovery. I believe that the trial was adjourned at a minimum once, possibly twice, and I can't recall the reasons. But that's what took us so long to get to the case. The trial did, in fact, occur last June of 2009. And so it's been over a year since the trial concluded as well.
The other question I have relates to the OLR's recommendation for a 60-day suspension. And would you explain to me what the reasoning is of OLR in making that recommendation to the court?
The OLR, in making its 60-day recommendation, looked at both the Wisconsin case law as well as the ABA model rules or the standards for imposing lawyer sanctions. The most similar case to the misconduct that occurred in this case was the disciplinary proceedings against Painman, which is 216 Wiz 2D 440 574 Northwest 2D 232. It's a 1998 case where Attorney Painman was suspended for accusing the judge of tampering with the record, failing to obey orders of various judges related to the child custody support, continually interrupting the judge and impugning the intent of a judge. The misconduct in that case was substantially similar to the misconduct that was engaged in by Mr. Summers at the May 24th, 2004 hearing. Yes.
Please continue.
Go ahead.
I looked at the Pangman case, and of course, Pangman, I think you did a 90-day, we did a 90-day suspension of Pangman. And I also recall a little bit of the Pangman case, that is that there were numerous violations of court order regarding custody and child support, in addition to comments about the court sanitizing the record and the other discourteous comments to the court. Violating court orders is a big thing for me. You know, it's something you dasn't do. and you don't have that here. Now, how do you relate the two, then, since what you do have is a commonality of being discourteous, speaking out in court, disrespect to the tribunal. So that's there's a commonality there. You had that in other cases where you didn't ask for suspension. So my question is, shouldn't the violation of numerous court orders be a distinguishing factor in the Pangman case from this case?
Yes, and I agree with that. And that's one of the reasons why, if you look at the case, Attorney Payman did violate numerous court orders. He received a 90-day suspension. When OLR looked at the case and analyzed the case, The OLR felt that a 60-day suspension was more in line with the behavior of Mr. Summers in this case. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of other cases in Wisconsin that are substantially similar to the case of Mr. Summers. However, the...
What about the Virginia Rose Ray case? In that case, I think you had, if I remember correctly, Judge Dyke was the subject of a difficult attorney, accusations about Judge Dyke. And in addition, I think there was some other stuff going on. There were 11 other violations found in the case, including two trust account violations and two excessive fee case violations. And there, the court imposed 60 days. So that's the same. Did you use the Virginia Rose Ray case as something to be considered?
The OLR did not look at Virginia Rose Ray when they were making the recommendation in this case.
What about the Crescetto case?
I don't believe that they looked at that case as well. The OLR looked at similar case law. They also looked at the aggravating factors under the ABA standards for imposing lawyer sanctions. They looked at the fact that Attorney Summers engaged in multiple violations of offenses during the Raceback matter. Just at the May 24, 2004 hearing alone, Mr. Summers violated SCR 20:3.5C, engaging in conduct intended to disrupt a tribunal, SCR 20:8.2A, a lawyer shall not make a statement that the lawyer knows to be false or with reckless disregard as to its truth or falsity concerning the qualifications or integrity of a judge, and SCR 20:8.4G, violating the attorney's oath.
Counselor, did Judge Pukowski hold Attorney Summers in contempt of court for his outburst before him?
No, he did not.
That would have been an option, certainly, for a judge to do when somebody gets out of hand in the courtroom, right?
That is correct. And Judge Pukowski, there are some comments in the record that Judge Pukowski had considered holding him in contempt of court, and then he provided some reasoning as to why he didn't hold him in contempt of court. Mm-hmm. And that was at the, I believe, the June 24th hearing,
where
Judge Pukowski informed Mr. Summers that, yes, he could have held him in contempt of court, and for some, he did not decide to do so at the May 24th hearing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And why did he decide not to do so at the May 24th hearing?
I
don't think that's in the record, is it?
There were some comments.
Yeah, I've looked at those comments, and I may be missing something, but I understood the comments to be reflective back to the May hearing, and he said that he could have. It was in the presence of the court. It disrupted the tribunal. There were 8 or 9 bailiffs, and certainly made, as I read it, he was laying the groundwork for what could have been a summary contempt proceeding, but I don't recall he said why he didn't do it. But maybe I missed that.
I think there's one part, and I don't have the direct quote in front of me at this point. I know that Judge Pukowski had indicated that he just felt at the time that it wasn't right for him to find him in contempt. And he never fully explained why he didn't feel it was right, and I can't recall, and I could certainly review the record. And
no, I just thought I had heard you say that, and it didn't jive with my recollection of the record. But that's fine. I just wanted to know if you could point to any place, and that's fine.
I know there's one comment somewhere that he alludes that he didn't feel it was appropriate at the time to find him in contempt. Going back to the OLR sanction recommendation, the OLR looked at the multiple counts of misconduct that Mr. Summers engaged in, not only under count 2, but under count 3, which relates to Mr. Summers' pretrial publicity under SCR 20:3.6.
That's the third count.
That's correct.
Okay.
And the OLR found that Mr. Summers, under the rule, knew participated or has participated in the investigation or litigation of a matter that the lawyer knows, or strike that, sorry. Under the rule, it states a lawyer who is participating or has participated in the investigation or litigation of a matter shall not make an extrajudicial statement that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know will be disseminated by means of public communication and will have a substantial likelihood of materially prejudicing an adjudicative proceeding. Under the rule, the OLR's position was that Summer knew or should have known that the information he publicized would not be admissible at trial. Summers brought various motions before the trial concerning prosecutorial misconduct, outrageous governmental misconduct, and suppression of evidence. All those motions were denied. The trial, in fact, was limited to the issue of whether or not Mr. Raisbach drove in a negligent manner, causing the death of Jerry Pagdaloff. Despite that fact, Summers published information concerning prosecutorial misconduct and factual detailed analysis with regard to expert opinions. He published those in the Isthmus, a local newspaper in the Dane County area, as well as a website called www.justicedanecountystyle.com.
Counselor, do you recall how this matter came before OLR? Did someone file a complaint against Mr. Summers saying certain things, or did Judge Bukowski refer him to you, or how did this come before OLR to start with?
There was a grievance filed against Mr. Summers.
By whom?
I know that the OLR received a letter, which is a part of the record, from Judy Schwamley, the
DA in Dane County. Yeah.
Okay. I believe that letter was the primary grievance letter that prompted the investigation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
To what extent did OLR consider any mitigating factors in relating in its desire for a 60-day suspension?
Well, if you look at the mitigating factors under the ABA standards, there's absence of a prior disciplinary record.
Is what?
Absence of a prior disciplinary record.
Okay.
That was taken into account. The other ones are absence of a dishonest or selfish motive. There's personal or emotional problems. The OLR didn't have evidence of any personal emotional problems in this case. Another factor under the mitigating factors is timely good faith effort to make restitution or to rectify consequences of misconduct. The OLR did not find any indications of that. Cooperative attitude towards the proceedings and inexperience in the practice of law. I believe out of all those mitigating factors, probably the one that the OLR did take into account was the absence of a prior disciplinary record. The OLR did
first
not.
First one.
Correct. The OLR did not take any of the other mitigating factors into account.
What about the mitigating factor, which you may or may not accept as either true or mitigating, that Mr. Summers represented a young man who was charged with negligent homicide? That this young man was the son of a personal friend, potentially facing not only criminal charges but prison. He was 17. The negligent homicide was going too fast for conditions, fog conditions. There was a death involved. And an injury. That whether true or not, Mr. Summers believed that the DA did not tell the truth about a subpoena. That whether true or not, Mr. Summers believed that the DA was using what Mr. Summers would have been thought of as unethical ways of putting pressure on a witness, Mr. McCoy, in order to get him to testify for the state instead of for his friend. That Mr. McCoy, that Mr. Summers viewed that in the case involving the 17-year-old, whether true or not, that the district attorney had withheld evidence that would have assisted the young man, that the DA, assistant DA, whether true or not, Mr. Summers believed that the assistant DA, from Mr. Summers' viewpoint, lied to the court about when he gave Mr. Summers the photographic and other evidence. I think you know what I'm referring to. That use was made of an expert from Mr. Summers' point of view, not necessarily true, that he believed the expert was using photographs that could not substantiate what the expert ultimately testified to. And then from Mr. Summers' standpoint, whether true or not, he believed that his client was, to use the kind of terminology Mr. Summers might use, was being railroaded by a prosecutor who wanted a conviction rather than wanting what prosecutors are supposed to want, truth and justice. And that no matter how Mr. Summers tried to tell this story to the court didn't seem to get it. This is all from Mr. Summers' standpoint, not what the court did or didn't get or what the assistant DA did or didn't do, but that's all from Mr. Summers' standpoint. And one could argue that there was enough in this record not to show that Mr. Summers was absolutely correct in what his views were, but there were kernels in there when put together, told a story. Didn't have to be the only story that the kernels told, but a story, which, considering Mr. Summers' relationship with the defendant and the defendant's family, could raise ire, right? And Mr. Summers now says, which would be hard not to say, he was disrespectful. His language was disrespectful. And yet he did lose his temper. I think that is obvious from the record. I mean, I can't hear it on the written word, but if you have six or seven bailiffs coming in, something was loud, right? So is that part of your mitigation? Or don't you think anything I said mitigates?
I don't believe that's a factor that should be looked at in mitigation of this.
You have to speak up. I'm sorry.
Excuse me?
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry.
Slow and in the microphone.
I don't believe any of those, anything that you mentioned is mitigates the misconduct that Mr. Summers engaged in this case. I agree that I believe Mr. Summers was highly emotionally involved in this case. However, Mr. Summers, as an attorney, as an officer of the court, because of that, took his actions to the extreme in violation of the Supreme Court's rules. I believe that Judge Pikowski, during the May 24, 2006 hearing, said it correctly, where he stated, I understand, and this is on page 16 of the referee's report, I understand passion. I've seen many of the defense attorneys that are sitting here passionate about what they do. They don't react in the manner that you just did. They don't. They tend to let go. They tend to make their case. They tend to make their motion. And if they lose it, they know there's an appellate route. This is the way to get someone to review this. I seriously question whether you've got yourself together, Joe Summers. I'm sorry, but you are not in control. I'm very fearful of going forward with a jury. It's almost a certain mistrial. It is almost impossible to get you to stop talking, and there was no stopping you minutes ago when you, all those bailiffs, there was no stopping you. Nothing I could have said or done. I believe as an officer of the court, as stated by Judge Bukowski, that there were appropriate avenues for Mr. Summers to take if he felt that there was injustice going on in this case. The way that he handled things and the way that he reacted was inappropriate and in violation of the Supreme Court rules. And as a result of his actions in this case, the OLR requests that this court find that he did violate counts 2 and 3 of the disciplinary case as found by this referee, and the OLR recommends that this court impose a 60-day suspension of his license.
You think that the third count is contrary to the First Amendment?
Is it covered under the First Amendment? Under the Gentile case, there's a balancing test that you look at in determining whether or not actions or speech are covered under the First Amendment. You have to look at whether or not his right to make statements or comments about the district attorney's office and the judges in this case outweighed the state's right to a fair trial or the public's right to a fair trial in this case. If you look at the facts and circumstances of this case, if you look at the details of the analysis, the materials that are contained in Mr. Summers' pretrial publicity, if you look at there's one page called the Raceback Case Made Simple that contains expert analysis. One of the experts on that analysis is an expert who's the information was provided to Mr. Summers through pretrial discovery. It was not made public. It was not in the court record. You also have an analysis of Robert Krenz's expert testimony, who in the JusticeDaneCounty.com internet site. All of that information, particularly with regard to Robert Krenz, was excluded from trial. Robert Krenz was not allowed to testify at trial with regard to any of those facts. All the information, a majority of the information about the Dane County District Attorney's Office, the judges, experts' opinions were not admissible at trial. Any juror that had their hands on that information, it could potentially prejudice their thoughts, feelings, processes at the trial level.
Clearly, you handle that on voir dire and striking jurors. This was all before trial, right?
This was all before trial. However, you need to weigh the impact of the public dissemination of information that Mr. Summers put out there versus the state's right to a fair trial. If this evidence or information was disseminated to the public, that has a high likelihood of prejudicing the trial. And that needs to be taken into consideration. If you look at the matter of Stephen Litt's case, which is an Indiana Supreme Court case, in that case, there was an attorney's letter to the area newspapers where the attorney made extrajudicial statements during his client's retrial. He asserted his client's innocence, criticized the prosecutor's decision to retry the case, and included information in there that his client had passed a lie detector test. In that case, the court held that there was a substantial likelihood that the information that the attorney in that case disseminated to the public would materially prejudice the jury trial. And I believe if you look at all the information that was contained within the newspaper articles and particularly within the website, which was referred to in the newspaper articles, I believe that all that material together would substantially, there's a substantial likelihood that it would impact the trial in this case.
I'm assuming that the OLR does not automatically check our decisions or those of the Court of Appeals or the trial courts when there's accusations within them that either the defense counsel or the prosecutor engaged in misconduct. Is that right?
No.
You do not check all those?
No, we do not. Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you, counsel.
Ms. Scott, I have one last
Justice
question.
Justice Crooks.
Following up on what the Chief Justice was asking you, my understanding is that there were three different judges involved in this matter. Maybe I'm missing somebody, but first Judge Higginbotham, then Judge Bukowski, then Judge Moser. Did any of those three judges issue a gag order to the attorneys in regard to what could or could not be said prior to trial or during trial?
No. I'm not aware of a gag order being put out.
If I may, refresh my recollection with regard to that part of count three, I think it was paragraph 61 to 53, that dealt with putting a flyer on jurors, potential jurors' windshields.
Sure.
What happened with regard to that?
There's no allegation that Mr. Summers actually, in fact, put out those flyers. The reason that the flyers are an issue is because there's evidence and testimony that those flyers contain the same or similar language to language that was contained in Mr. Summers' websites. It contains a lot of the same allegations, the same factual analysis, and the flyers are essentially evidence of the effect of Mr. Summers' pretrial publicity. Whether Summers was involved or not, somebody took the information that was set forth or put out by Mr. Summers and placed them on these flyers. And one of the concerns about at least one of the flyers is one of the flyers was, in fact, placed on, there's a level in the Dane County parking ramp, or the previous Dane County parking ramp where all the jurors are assigned to park. And on May 24th, 2004, there was going to be voir dire with regard to the trial and the raceback matter. Those flyers were placed on the same level in the parking ramp in which the jurors parked for voir dire for the raceback trial that day. And so, just in sum, these flyers were evidence of what happens when you place that type of information out there and it gets promulgated to the public.
Was there any indication during voir dire that those flyers or any other pretrial, publicity was heard by any juror or infected any juror?
I don't believe that because this was the May 24th, 2004 hearing in front of Judge Pukowski, I don't believe that there was any voir dire done on that day because the trial was continued.
Voir dire, I've been reading some of this stuff, and there's a lot to read. There was a voir dire done, and if I recall, there was a juror that was struck because of knowledge of Mr. Humphrey. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think any juror was struck with regard to any pretrial publicity.
I believe ultimately, I'm just going from my memory at this point, I believe that when voir dire actually did occur for the trial, that none of the jurors were struck due to pretrial publicity. That's my understanding.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Scott. Mr. Summers, you have 10 minutes on a not overly fast clock.
Okay. Your Honor, I will begin with where she left off. Actually, her last statement is factually not accurate. And it's critical and it's understandable, and I don't see how she could have gotten it wrong, and this Court should know because it's been pointed out both in my brief and my reply brief, and the record says it. There was indeed a juror who was struck in voir dire. He was struck because of the pretrial publicity in that case. He was struck because he was biased against Raisback. And why was he biased against Raisback? Undoubtedly because Channel 27 had been fed a story that was print or that was put on the air prior to the trial that Razorback, the speed of the trial, that the state was going to be proving that Razorback was driving in excess of 100 miles an hour, when in fact at that time the state's position was the speed could not have been more than 76 miles per hour. Channel 27 retracted their story on their website. They refused to do so on the air. But that was the bias that was against Razorback at trial. Of course, nothing that I could have remotely been connected to could have even come close to being the equivalent of this planted false story, which was Channel 27 ran with. In regards to three things that she brought up, I would like to touch upon. First,
I want to ask you something before you get started. Why did you give the interview to Isthmus? What did you think you were doing?
Actually, I'm not 100% on that. I don't really recall it. But if my memory is correct, Paul Humphrey was interviewed in that same issue. So we both were interviewed at the very same time. Second, in regards to that, as this Court knows, and that was one of the things I was going to touch upon, there is an exception to the rule. And the exception says an attorney can go public, warning of a danger concerning the behavior of a person involved when there is reason to believe that there exists the likelihood of a substantial harm to an individual or to the public interest.
What did you think you were warning if you're going to use that?
One was the public. Should the public be warned that a district attorney's office has, one, knowingly commenced a vehicle homicide when they knew their evidence was false? Two, should the public become aware that a district attorney's office knowingly utilized falsified testimony in order to have the individual bound over in the case to proceed?
So you wanted to put your view of the facts before the public, and that's why you did the interview.
Actually, I wanted at that point in time, for the same reason, I mean at these periods of time, I wanted the responsible people to step in. I had already gone to the court. Adam Razorback is a small man today. He was a smaller man back then. He was a 17-year-old kid, if I'm not 17, 18-year-old kid. We're talking about convicting a kid from a criminal conspiracy. No, Your Honor, you're asking me why. That's why.
Slow down, okay? Slow down, Counselor. You're a fine advocate. You're a fine advocate, and I'm not trying to get in the way of that. I'm just trying to understand what occurred here in light of what you've been charged with, okay? And you've been involved in this for years, though I can tell you I've spent many, many hours and hours reading stuff. I don't know a tenth of what you probably know. So if you listen to me and answer my questions, you can probably help me out. And my question was, first of all, why'd you give the interview, okay? So you're telling me you gave the interview to warn the public. Well, you gave the interview prior to trial. Why did you give it at that time if you wanted to warn the public?
Because, Your Honor, I was authorized to do so by the Supreme Court rules. That's the thing that nobody wants. That's one of the elephants in the room that nobody wants to go.
Counselor, I'm not worried about the rule. I'm trying to figure out factually why did you do what you did. And you were not reading the Supreme Court rule before you went and had an interview with Isthmus.
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
So you read it. You read the rule and you decided this is what I should do under the rule?
I did look it up. Yes, Your Honor, I am a responsible man. At that time, I had 9 kids. I am not reckless when it comes to supporting my family.
All right, if you tell me.
Looked it up. Okay. That's the whole point. That's the elephant in the room, of course, that everybody wants to ignore. And that goes back to one of the key things. This court basically, through the Chief Justice, gave what if, basically, whether it's true or not. The fact of the matter is, it is true, and it's not because I say so. It is very inaccurate to say that I say so. That's why the 6 days of evidentiary hearing had to be put on the kibosh. That's why they need to be excluded from the record. Because what took place in those 6 days of evidentiary hearing? What was testified to? One, Krenz testified. Before they commenced the prosecution, they knew the evidence that Humphrey was using was invalid and falsified. That's part of the testimony. Two, the statement that Krenz testified to on Humphrey's behalf was false. Krenz conceded he could not have truthfully said that. Three, Nasinski testified. They then came up with a second falsified analysis in the presence of him, Krenz, and Humphrey. Four,
Nasinski testified the photographic evidence that proved the whole thing was false. Humphrey literally told him to remove that photographic evidence from a deputy's locker, bring it to Krenz's office, and it was falsely represented in court that neither Nasinski nor Humphrey knew where the exculpatory evidence was. And five, Humphrey's own subordinate testified that the warrant, the affidavit to get the warrant on McCoy was false. Six, the detective testified that the statements that Olvar gave her, had put in her mouth in order to justify the allegation on count one, were not true. She never said those things. She never could have said those things. Those are the things that all came out at those evidentiary hearings. And when she says, I have an affirmative defense, my God, that sins against the light. I was told after 6 days of evidentiary hearings that the evidence didn't count, literally didn't count. All you have to do is look at the referee's order and decision. The name Krenz never comes up. The name Nasinski never comes up. He, as he said he would, he ignored it. It didn't count. That's what took place. To say that, that's like saying you have a, hey, you can play a baseball game, and if you win, we'll say you won. But all the runs that you score, they don't count. And besides that, of course, because of this court's particular rules, I got to pay for them, for the 6 days of evidentiary hearings that don't count. Due to this court's peculiar rules, I have to pay the referee for his time. I have to pay Olvar for their time. And for why this matter took so long, Judge Justice Crooks, two things should be pointed out. First, there was an appeal. Remember that, Judge? We were here before because there was an appeal granted to Olvar, an appeal that was worthless, lasted for a year or so, cost me thousands of dollars. Now I got to pay for their time when this court's ruling was rendered worthless by the referee's actions. And in addition to deposing these people, the depositions, I was shut down from deposing people up until spring of 2008. That's right, spring of 2008. I had to fight tooth and nail to be able to depose people. During the process, Olvar was caught repeatedly making falsified assertions in order to cut off the depositions. They repeat, one of them being that they had investigated whether or not Justice Crooks' son's client, Krenz, had committed perjury. They said that they had investigated that. He had been cleared. Then they turned around and had to admit under oath that wasn't true.
Okay,
but they put that out to kill off the depositions.
Counsel, maybe careful what I ask for. I might get it. And that is with regard to context. You know, I think the context is important. But the things that you're relating now, I've got to narrow down to what's the issue before the court. The issue before the court, in part, is, was there a violation in count two?
And I would say no if you see it as the elements. You want to say I was disrespectful on that day? Go ahead. As I've said since the very beginning, go ahead and say it. I'm not going to argue it. You want to say that I made a statement and knowingly, with reckless disregard of the truth? And that is the rub, because the whole thing is to discredit me on what I was saying in court. No, everything I said that day was true, and I've proven it over and over and over.
Okay, with regard to count three.
First of all, in regards to count three, none of the statements that she has said today is very misleading. In regards to, I didn't violate any order. In fact, I think in her brief it says there was some sequestration order. No, never took place. Two, I never controlled any website. Now, did I participate with the website? Yeah, I didn't publish anything. I didn't control anything. Three, in regards to this whole thing with the jurors, it's amazing that this is even being said. It shows, in all due respect, that something is way off the tracks. Her boss, under oath, said I had been cleared, that it never should have been included in the complaint. It was never even presented to the PRC. And that I had been cleared, that I had nothing to do with it. Then how then can it be resurrected at a hearing where I'm not even present and now to be considered against me? I don't think that's just. And again, Your Honor, I guess to wrap it all up, I see that the red light. Here's what I think should be done. Number one, in count two, you want to say I was disrespectful? Go ahead. But you owe it to me because you owe it to the cause of justice and to the citizens of this state to acknowledge that what I said in court that day was in good faith. In regards to count three, Everything I did in that day was authorized by the Supreme Court rules, and incidentally authorized by Judge Murkowski on May 24th. I think it's about somewhere in the page 50s. He said, you can take your claims public. He said it in court. And so what I did on that day, everything I did was in good faith. And it should also, again, be seen that what I did, I was trying to alert the public to something that was truly, gravely evil. It was immoral. It was evil. And the public needed to be aware. And to act like you can do something on appeal when you convict a young teenage boy through a fraudulent case, like somehow, well, we can fix it a few years later. As this court knows, a judge, as everybody here knows, appeals take a long time. I guess if he rotted in prison for a couple of years, well, we can all say then maybe he could have gotten, maybe then he could put his life together. It'd be a good learning education experience. I didn't see it that way. So everything I did in count three, I say, was justified. And in the end...
Counselor, did you anticipate that any of the prospective jurors would hear what you had to say or read what you had said in regard to the trial?
Your Honor, that's why I did it exactly the way that I did it. And that's why no jurors did. When they were voir dired, Your Honor, that proves that I did it the way that I, in a very responsible way. That's why not a single juror was aware of it.
Okay, so
I never intended to get it out to the general.
So the answer to my question is no. You didn't do it to provide this information to a potential juror.
No, I did it to provide it in the public. The public is a big thing.
No, I understand. Right. I just want you to answer my question.
Right. Okay. And there were segments of the public that I thought, the responsible, basically, segments of the public, I wanted to become aware of it. And I did it carefully in that way. And again, it cannot be overlooked. Somebody planted, in this case, a falsified story that could have sent the boy down. That was the thing that was the most troubling of all. And for some reason, even to this day, nobody cares to find out who fed that falsified story to Channel 27.
Now, they probably won't tell. They generally protect their sources, so you're probably out.
That's probably true, and that's why in the DA's office would have probably known that. But the bottom line is, somebody did. We know it's a fact. And the third thing I just like to say before I go is, I think one of the mitigating factors, she said, selfish motive or something like that. Well, you know what? I must really be a fool, and I think the justice has sort of conceded I'm not a dumb guy. I would really have to be the dumbest guy in the whole world if that due to some kind of selfish motive, I would set everything up where I would financially ruin my family, destroy my profession, destroy my reputation. And if this is what my motive was, I don't think there's a single one of you that can believe that for one moment. And if that's not a mitigating factor, I don't know what is in the considerations of what is just.
Thank you, Mr. Summers. And thank you, Ms. Scott, for your arguments and your responses to the court's questions and your various filings in this case. Court will take this under advisement, and as I say in every judicial and lawyer discipline case, these are always the hardest that the court has to face, and so ends our hearing in 06 AP 2851D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Joseph Summers. That ends our November calendar. And the court will meet in the conference room at 3:30. That's 20 minutes instead of our usual 30. The Marinette students, can you stay to talk with Justice Crooks, or must you leave? Somebody should talk with me. Pardon me? You're on for a short time. All right. Good. Anyone else who wishes to leave may do so. Anyone who wishes to stay and listen to the conversation about the procedure of the court may stay. The court is adjourned for the November sitting.